To what extent did the government of the Protectorate rest solely on bayonets?
I'll seize the initiative immediately in a very Cromwellian way by asking John to do some speaking. And Luke's explaining that neither John nor I have any idea of what's forthcoming. We have no idea of whether we're going to be natural allies in what we have to say, or if we're going to differ in our opinions. But we do have an existing professional relationship. It began here. Selwyn is where I came for my very first undergraduate tutorials, which I enjoyed, just in a room across the path there with Blair Worden, when he was a fellow of Selwyn. And then when John arrived, I met him and we planned out my doctoral thesis together. Because nobody in Oxford knew anything about the Civil War in those days. I used to hitchhike from Oxford to Cambridge in order to meet John and learn about the things which I wanted to discuss. And so the root of my career was here in Selwyn College in these informal tutorials with John, the one person I could find in England who actually spoke a common language and knew what I was trying to write and talk about in my thesis. So I'm coming back to base here. And I want to start by asking John about the book that he is writing for Bloomsbury, the Harry Potter Press, the book which, in John's own vision, is intended to be a history of Oliver Cromwell, which the public can read, understand, and enjoy, which can at last, after almost half a century, replace Lady Antonia Fraser's Chief of Men upon the book stands at airports and train stations. So what is your vision for this book, John? And how does it refer to the topic of our debate?
Comforting old age. I don't want to say first that what three of us here on the panel are involved in, a team of nine, is the first ever proper edition of all Oliver Cromwell's words. There are biographies every other year of Cromwell. I think there have probably been about 25 in the last 40 years, at least 25, and they're all based on bad editions of Cromwell's words. They were first assembled heroically. It was a heroic effort to a man who believed in heroes, Thomas Carlyle, in the 1840s, but he simply transcribed not all that well what was available in London and what people sent him. Now, that was sort of modernised or improved in the early 20th century, and the person who did it did a respectable job, but she was so deferential to Carlyle that she still left, you know, a great deal of his presuppositions in. And then a professor in Harvard set out to do a proper edition, again, on his own in the 1930s. And unfortunately, the Second World War came along, and he couldn't get over here to actually look at the original, so he had to do a huge amount of improvisation. He also made some catastrophic editorial decisions. I mean, in what we're going to be talking about today, the 1650s, where you have different versions of Cromwell's recorded words, like speeches, where different people made either in manuscript or in print, produced versions of his speeches. Abbott in Harvard catastrophically produced a digest. I mean, he produced a mixture, a blend, which is absolutely terrible. So what we're doing now as a team is producing a major new edition that won't add a huge amount to the number of known Cromwell letters or speeches. It will actually question whether some of them are really by Cromwell, whether they're forgeries or more often misattributions, letters which are anonymised, but an historian has taken to be by Cromwell, and some of those are amongst the most cited. So there will be a stabilisation of the edition, but the actual texts themselves will be an altogether higher authority. And that is the background to feeling the time was right for a new biography. There have been 25 biographies over the last 40 years or so, but overwhelmingly they're aimed at you lot. They're aimed at students and at students at sixth form and undergraduate level. There hasn't been a really serious attempt to produce a biography of this this extraordinary figure in our history, designed for wider publics. I use that because it's not for Joe public, as it were, or Joan public. It's for that sort of that the people who read history books for pleasure and because they are deeply interested in it. I had the great advantage in life having a father-in-law who, because of the Second World War, didn't go to university. If he had, he would have read history. He was at Brentwood School, he would have read history. He was passionate about history, and he used to read history books on the train from Epsom Downs to Central London every day. And I always write for him, as it were, because he is the target audience, an intelligent, curious man who is deeply immersed in the physical remains of our history. So a great visitor of National Trust properties and so on. That is a market that we need to write. So my biography, Ronald, is really if it's being read on the 7:15 from Epsom Downs to Holborn Viaduct, I will have done well. But the real justification is it will be a biography based on the new texts. And we may come later today to one or two of the ways in which it's already clear that the new texts are going to change our view. I'm the general editor. David and Patrick are, in fact, the two who are responsible for the protectorate period. My own personal responsibility is for the life up to 1649, and I'm in the middle at the moment of editing the letters from the autumn of 1648.
So from your experience then, how do you think it's likely to be good thesis about the military rule in the 1650s.
Yes, so I'm coming now to the topic, but I think that's just the context which Ronald invited me to make. Cromwell, for me, comes out of all the work I've done, and this perhaps will be more in our session, Patrick, as being a far more worldly wise politician, much less starry eyed than perhaps he's sometimes portrayed, much less of a simple idealist. He is an idealist, but the more cunning side of him and the more calculating side of him has become clearer to me, I think, as a result of my editing. Shall I carry on? On the protectorate? Let's talk about it. Was it a military dictatorship? Well, clearly the protectorate is created by military force. I mean, an army coup both removed the king and subsequently removed the parliament that had been the instrument of removing the king. There was a coup in 1649. In other words, there was a military coup in the spring of 1653, and although one can't say straightforwardly there was a military coup that actually got rid of the nominated assembly in December 1653, there was certainly a military takeover for the brief interregnum, and it was a predominantly military decision what to put in its place. In other words, the protectorate itself was a constitution which had its origins in the debates in the army, and in fact looked back to army constitutional thinking in the late 1640s. So in that very simple sense, it is a regime which couldn't have existed but for the army. And to say that it couldn't have survived but for the army is a fairly meaningless phrase, because most regimes can't survive without the threat of force. I think probably once it's established that the protectorate is less of a sort of military regime than the ones which follow, the regimes of Charles II, James II, William III, or Anne, faced by, in the latter cases, by Jacobite threats. And James I had an enormous standing army to try to force through extremely unpopular change. And in that sense, I don't think the protectorate is as militarised. Now, I'm talking here entirely about England. If you're in Ireland or Scotland, you do have a military regime. I don't know whether you want to use the word dictatorship, but you have a regime which is entirely dominated by the army. As the protectorate goes on, the physical presence of the army in England shrivels away. I mean, from the end of 1654 onwards, the number of troops maintained in England is dropping from about 15,000 to about 4,000, 3,000 or 4,000. There are barracks in central London, as a clear reminder to anyone who attempts a coup in London that there's a strong presence in London. But vast numbers of garrisons are discontinued around the country, and they're scaled right back. The amount spent on the army in England is probably about, it's certainly less than Charles II ever spent on his garrisons, and an awful lot less than his successors, particularly once you've got the Jacobite threat. So in that sense, the certain presence of the army is scaled back. Military men play a prominent part in central government, but they don't have an all-encompassing part. They're not a simple majority of the Council of State, though they're a clear presence on the Council of State. They're not acting in major ways. People, both serving and former new model officers, are not in a controlling position in local government, though they are in Scotland and Ireland. Garrison commanders in Scotland and Ireland are also having very major civil powers. The extent of military law, the trial of people by Roman law or martial law, remains for treason. I mean, treason trials are still held under martial law, though not by judges made up of soldiers, but it is a part of the military tradition. That, of course, is what happens after a revolution. You can't really set up jury trials in such highly politicised circumstances. But for ordinary justice, day by day, in the civil courts and the criminal courts, you wouldn't have felt there was any real difference between the period before or after. If anything, you probably had a higher standard of justice in the 1650s than before or later. The army isn't involved as it was quite a lot in the Restoration, in tax collecting. Taxes are collected by civil commissioners under normal rules. The local militias, except for the specific period of the major generals, are local gentry controlling local militias. We might want to go into the major generals as a special episode. I'll assume for them you know who they were. But the important point about the major generals is this: that in Cromwell's conception, and particularly Lambert's conception, the major generals were a way of reducing the taxation. Reduce taxation on the general population, reduce the standing army very significantly, replace it by an efficient militia of demobilised veterans paid for by the royalists who they needed to police. And looked at like that, it is an attempt to reduce rather than to increase military power in England. So I think my initial opening statement is that we can never forget that the Protectorate was created out of army putches, but it was not any more of a militarised regime than most of the ones which succeeded it, and which we don't ever think of as military dictatorships, like Charles II, James II, or William III.
Okay. I agree with all that, but all I shall do to provide a counterbalancing picture is emphasise the bits of your portrait that you did not emphasise. I totally agree with all the things on which you've placed the stress. First, you've looked forward from the 1650s to the late Stuarts and the Hanoverians. Looking backwards, the perspective shifts dramatically. Because you're looking at Tudor and Stuart societies, especially those from Elizabeth onwards, where the presence of royal guards themselves is very understated. They are present, but they are not seen as a military presence as such. So the transformation from a largely demilitarized society of the early 17th century at home into a militarized one in the 1640s and 1650s is extremely dramatic. And the protectorate, I agree, is the least militarized part, the least obviously and blatantly militarized portion of that period, but it is still lodged there of a continuum from 1642 to 1660. And when you look at the debates over the standing army of William III in the late 1690s, those debates refer backwards to two traumatic points, and they are James II, and I would very much say that the later regime of James II is a militarised society, with a huge army encamped in Hounslow Heath, overawing London, and that's the way it's seen and remembered. But the same debates also look backwards to the 1650s as being a time of oppressive militarisation. Whether it's just or not, that is the way it set itself in the memory of the English, let alone the Irish and the Scots. So clearly there is more going on here than one can measure simply by looking at the number of soldiers, the taxes levied to support them. And the other point I bring in is the fact that you do have here a situation in which, arguably, if you remove the guards from Charles I in the 1630s, the regime is probably going to be there the next year. If you remove the guards of Charles II in the 1670s, it is probable the regime will survive. Remove Cromwell's army, it is difficult to imagine the protectorate being maintained in its present form. And this is surely proven by 1660, when you have a different army suddenly in charge, and the entire Republican experiment collapses overnight. So this is not simply a case of the army installing regimes, being ultimately responsible for them. The army is actually prescribing the nature of the regime and the policies with which it is largely associated, especially with regard to freedom of conscience in religion and to reform of the electoral and representative system. And some of those policies are so deeply unpopular with such a large number of the population that they essentially present a problem for the regime in acquiring legitimacy that is simply not there for many of the regimes before and many of those after. So those are the shades I would colour in your picture, while not wishing to knock a single prop out of what you stated.
John, would you like to come back on?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's quite clear that there's a big change between the 16th century and the early 17th century. That's absolutely valid. Of course, once the Civil War happens, that militarisation could happen. I mean, if Charles I had won the Civil War, then there at least as much militarisation for 16 decades as we promised. So that is simply the outcome of Civil War. But of course, the memory of Civil War is very important in stabilising the regime in the 1650s. What Cromwell could never get was the kind of passionate support that he wanted beyond the his veterans in the army and the godly. But he could get acquiescence, because to destabilise that regime would plunge you back into something that was an awful lot worse than you're experiencing, which was anarchy and civil war. So, I mean, I've always been very taken with the man in Cheshire, where I started my research 50 years ago, God help us. When I started my research, I came across a man who wrote and said that to Cromwell and said that he would never oppose him, but he deserved to be hanged for a fool if he thought I would help him up if once he stumbled. Now that seems to me to be that's Adam Martindale. That seems to me really, really important that there's a level of acquiescence in the protectorate because of the fear of going back to anarchy. And of course, Cromwell was able to much more freely, actually. I suppose that's not quite true. In a different way. He was completely open to people coming to see him. He went riding in Hyde Park on his own. There was one serious assassination attempt, but he didn't deter him. And so he was able to go out on his own, not in fear. He wasn't having to go everywhere under armed escort and so on. So again, I think we have to, if we contextualise it, yes, the 1650s is different from the 1630s, but that is the product of civil war, not the product of anything intrinsic, you know, to Cromwell.
I think, just to interject there, Blair Worden has written about the army causing a problem of legitimacy for the Protectorate. How would you both respond to that?
I am happy to suggest that this is absolutely correct. I accept completely again what John has said about the acquiescence of a population in the regime and the view of Cromwell as a hope that stability may not just be preserved, but may be consolidated, may be increased. But we bang up here against the single enormous obvious point that at no point, that no year in its career does the Protectorate manage to make its own constitution work properly. In other words, it is incapable of calling a parliament which can accept its existing constitution, vote it the taxes it needs to cover its expenses, and provide a sure way into the future. It comes closest to it in 1657 with the humble petition and vice, but that itself proves unworkable a few months later in the next session of the same parliament. So this is not business as usual politically. It isn't even consolidation. And when you factor in the fact that the religious thermometer is rising, not falling, with the spread of the Quaker movement, the spread of the sects, an increasing sense of polarisation and instability in society, the number of time bombs ticking under the Protectorate begins to look quite impressive.
Well, many of the problems of maintaining the regime in the early 1650s had been only sustained by selling assets, by asset sales. I mean, something like, all the crown lands, that's about 8 or 9% of the land of England, all the crown lands were sold. All the land which belonged to bishops and to cathedrals, deans and chapters, which is another 9 or 10%, had been sold. And the convicted royalists were divided into two groups, delinquents and malignants. Delinquents are those who had fought, but, you know, had just been unwise, but the malignants were the people who, well, they were war criminals, all Catholics in arms, for example. And now they were that had all their lands compulsorily sold, and that's 900 nobles and gentry. But no, those are one-off sales, and I think part of the problem for the Protectorate is that it doesn't any longer have any, not only does it have nothing it can sell, it has nothing to use as security against loans. So I do think that, and I think that may be one of the reasons why there is an attempt to cut back on the presence of the army in England. I want to repeat, it is a very, very massive demobilisation. England is reasonably pacified, but the trouble is Ireland certainly isn't. And, I mean, although there have been 30,000 men in arms in Ireland when the Protectorate started, even at the end, I think something like 18,000. And 18,000 men is incredibly expensive. And so high taxation is another reason why people... So the trick is, how do you get people to move from acquiescence in the regime to active encouragement of it? Well, they want lower taxes and fewer soldiers. And you can't do that without putting security at an acceptable list. And, of course, you know, Ireland had always been a drain on the English exchequer. I mean, for 100 years, England couldn't afford to defend Ireland. So, I mean, Strafford was sent to Ireland in the 1630s, basically to balance the books. I mean, that was his aim. And he did it largely by going after the colonists rather than the native population, because the colonists wouldn't rebel and the native population would. And even that didn't work. So there are structural problems which aren't resolved, but they are, again, some of these are ones which are going to exist before and going to continue after this regime. I mean, Ireland is, once we got caught up in the vicious attempt to take over direct rule of Ireland from the 1540s onwards, I think that's going to keep English politics in a highly unstable state for centuries.
I accept all that as well. What I'll do again is shine a torch into the areas of your picture which are not so well lit up. For example, the fact that I have just stressed the problem of legitimacy as being one of managing a parliament, getting a partnership with it. But of course, there's the other side. Why can the regime not get on with parliaments? Well, the answer is the army has a programme from which most of it in the end will not budge. Mm. And that makes negotiating with parliaments extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible. And every time there seems a possibility that the regime is going to take a list to the right, which may actually lead to a rapprochement with the old order, the political nation, a means of salvaging things in the Civil War period, which can go on indefinitely, the army blocks it, and blocks it very strongly. Yeah. And the problem of finances is not just a problem of balancing the books, it's also a problem of an increasingly, quietly but powerfully discontented army. Because what is happening is that an enormous gamble is being taken by the government of cutting the number of soldiers, yes, but never below the level where the existing regular taxes can support them, which means that the soldiers' pay is sliding further and further into arrears as the protectorate goes on, until by Cromwell's death, it is a really serious grievance demanding drastic action on the part of the government. And really, the options left, I'm not going too far into Richard Cromwell here, as I know that's coming, the options left are pretty daunting. And they are because of this extraordinary bind on politics of an ultimately all-powerful group of armed men with a programme on which they're not going to compromise very far.
Yeah, I only glossed that in one way, then I think we should open it up. What was really... I mean, the early protectorate, most of the people who'd fought in the First Civil War had been demobilised. I mean, the rank and file are largely new men, professional soldiers recruited... but the officer corps had remained very, very much the same. They'd become career soldiers. I think we've got to look into their mindset, which is they had seen so many people they knew and respected die. They'd seen a great many more wounded. They had to ask themselves, what was the purpose of all this suffering? And I think if we factor that into their religious convictions, and as we don't just take their religious convictions as being a set of intellectual propositions, but as growing out an experience that all this suffering had to have a deeper purpose, that purpose had to be a divinely ordained purpose, and there is a kind of an enormous moral obligation that the officers feel to the sufferings that their men had undergone in order to get rid of tyranny. Remember, they genuinely believe they've overthrown tyranny. They've overthrown a tyrant, Charles I. They've overthrown a tyrannical church. They've created a context within which religious freedom can flourish. And that absolutely has to be cherished and supported. But for those that want to say, actually, the whole of the 1640s was a terrible mistake, let's get back as close as we can to the conditions before 1640, there's this an absolutely tension that could never be resolved. That's my gloss on your sort of thing. So, but I think now we should open it both to you two and to everybody.
I think, yeah. David, you want to come in?
Yes, just one question, really, because I think what you both said about the demilitarised nature of the regime is very convincing and really runs counter very much to this idea of it resting solely on bayonets. I just wonder where this leaves the Major General's episode, because if there's one moment that leads to a huge sort of cry against swordsmen, it's the Major General's. How do we interpret that within the history of the Protectorate? Is it a blip, or is it difference of degree or kind?
It's a definite attempt to get away from a standing army and all the unpopularity, all the expense and all the unpopularity from garrisons in all the major towns. Get away from that, but to maintain security. After all, there has just been a royalist uprising. So you have to have to improve security. So let's have not local militias that are training for about 2 or 3 days a year, but militias that are efficient and which train regularly. But there are militias. Now, there will be a very senior military commander in charge, but under the senior military commander are bodies of commissioners who are much more local gentry and obviously supporters of the regime. But nonetheless, they're not obviously a military force. So you put the 11 major generals around the country in charge, but under them, you make it look as unlike a standing army as you can.
I have a different view, although it's not an opposed view, again. I would see the army and its reform programme as being the driving force from 1647 to 1660. And I would see a continuum along the way. I think if you look at the army, it makes sense of everything that's happening, as opposed to being a series of reactions of different kinds. There's a common theme. But from 1647 onwards, what the army wants is a New England based on a broadly defined national church, probably without tithes and with freedom of conscience for groups who wish temporarily to worship outside it, a reform of Parliament to make it more regular and on a different, more rational franchise, and a reform of the law to make it faster and cheaper in some way. And the revolution, the purging of Parliament, the destruction of the House of Lords is expected by the army to pave the way for this. It doesn't, so in the end, the purged Parliament gets liquidated. And they take the only step which would, in practical terms, allow their revolution to happen, which is to choose MPs themselves. That's the revolutionary moment. That's when they're almost going the way of Robespierre or the Bolsheviks, the cadre, the revolutionary cadre, to impose a settlement to the nation. And it fails. They don't quite have the nerve to go the extra mile and pick only the zealots. And it collapses. And what to me the Protectorate is a series of attempts to tame parliaments, to tame the political nation, to bridle and ride them. Not for nothing is it that supreme cavalryman, Lambert, who probably designs it. So you have a powerful council and a single person to bridle and manage the elected House of Commons, to run it, to get it to accept the idea of reform. And when this fails catastrophically in 1654-5, with both a no-go parliament and a royalist rebellion, the major generals are sent in to give the country a taste of reform at the grassroots level, to habituate it to the good country that might be produced if the army's views are taken. And it's only when this does not produce a workable parliament that Cromwell backs off. And for the first time, that parliament produces a counter-proposal, which is, if the army abandons its reform programme, in essence, it can have a settlement. And the army doesn't. And what Cromwell produces is an attempt to show the army that the Parliament's deal can be accepted, but with the army still building in its ideals and still in charge of things, a big presence in the upper house, Cromwell still in charge, and the same kind of army in existence. And it fails. And so the army tries again a new solution in 59. So to me, this is the driving force throughout. And the major generals make perfect sense to me within this series of attempts.
I think the major generals, they're coming to stay. There's no doubt Lambert designs the idea. It's Lambert who comes up with the idea of running, really, halving taxation from a very high level, halving it, getting rid of the standing army, replacing it by this militia of veterans. It's Cromwell, I'm pretty certain, though the evidence isn't conclusive, I think, but Cromwell then says, while they're busy doing this, they could also introduce, and this is, of course, the famous phrase he uses, the reformation of manners. Now, the reformation of manners, at one time, it was very easy to talk about this because it's very much the programme of making people virtuous. You know, it's no sex, no drink, no gambling. Would be a perfectly good summary of it. How do we get people away from living fleshly lives, as Cromwell would say, towards the lives of the spirit? How do we turn people from the things of the flesh and the things of the spirit? And that is a disastrous addition to what I think originally had been a much more demilitarizing activity. But I would insist that the people who put in charge of it day by day include a lot of local gentry. It isn't the army reshaping itself as a militia in any simple sense. So anyway, Patrick, you've not had to say yet.
Well, I want to open it up to discussion, really. So, are there any questions or comments on what you've heard so far? Anything you'd like to put to the experts, and or anything you can pick them up on?
To what extent does the army actually retain its influence because Cromwell remains himself part of it, so that he shares that vision rather than it being forced on him? Is he actually part of it and responsive?
Well, there would have been a right mess if he'd now died in 1654 or 1655, I think. I mean, I think he is the essential figure. He is the only man. He is the only. I suspect that Ronald and I might agree on this, that actually Lambert would have made a very good Lord Protector. That Lambert is much more sort of solidly, Yorkshire country gentry. He's not got that hard edge of fanaticism about religious toleration or the Reformation manners that Cromwell has got. I think he might have been a more comfortable figure for the country gentry than Cromwell. Cromwell was always too restless. So I don't think that there weren't alternatives, but it's very hard to see the scenario in which Lambert, who was always a kind of outsider in the top ranks of the army, because he was a Yorkshireman who had never served in the New Model during the First Civil War. He was up in Yorkshire until 1649. But there is at least one general who, if the other generals had trusted him, could have done a job at least as good as Cromwell. There's a side of me which thinks that he was kept out when Cromwell died. I believe in very few conspiracy theories. But the conspiracy theory that the civilians on the council suppressed a nomination by Cromwell of Lambert is one I'm willing to entertain. Because Cromwell, under the terms of the Humble Petition of Advice, had an obligation to nominate his successor. It just seems inconceivable to me there wouldn't have been a letter. And it's also inconceivable to me that there weren't people who were willing to open that letter to see if the name pleased them. And the way in which this long council meeting was held before they announced that Cromwell was dying, Bradford said, "Richard." It still seems to me more likely that that's what you come up with if you're in a real fix, because Cromwell has left a nomination that at least one party, which has destroyed the letter, isn't willing to entertain. So there is a possibility of a great missed story there of what would have happened if Lambert had replaced Cromwell. I lean towards Rommel's view. I mean, I think he's persuaded me over time of this, that the problems which are mounting up Protectorate would have been insurmountable for anybody. But I'm sure that Lambert would have had a much better go at it.
Yeah.
And he'd have kept the respect of the common soldiers much longer.
I'll partly there by also suggesting that the growing tension within the councils of the Protectorate is partly functional, but it's an impossible situation, and people have different views. But I also have a sense, from which you may depart, of Cromwell deliberately building up a civilian interest, winning over people who had been royalists or had been conservative Presbyterians, and balancing them off against the old military interest in the Protectorate, partly to stabilise the regime and broaden its base of support, but also, and this is where we hover precariously on the edge of seeing the same thing or not, because dividing and ruling was very good for his personal authority.
Yeah.
You see it in nation after nation. Cromwell pits people against each other, with the almost inevitable consequence, when you pick Cromwell out, the House of Cards begins to fall in.
I think after the regicide, which was only such a tiny number of MPs had been willing to go along with, perhaps 40, you can see Cromwell working tirelessly to broaden the basis of the support for the regime.
Yeah.
And I think he does the same in the Protectorate. He always recognises that you cannot... He has this obligation to deliver the fruits of revolution, political and religious liberty in his terms. But he can only do that if he can broaden the basis of support. And of course, a very delicate balance act. So, if you broaden it too far, it will inhibit your. So, that is the tension, that's the central tension in the Protectorate, and I agree with that entirely.
I think there is a difference between us. I think instinctually our Cromwells are still separate.
I'm sure they have
come together because of one thing, and that is that back when the chorus of praise for Cromwell was almost universal among respectable historians, I saw him as a much more slippery, much more cunning, much more calculating and manipulative, a much politically shrewder character than many, instead of this plain, blunt, idealistic man. And that shaded for me into a selfishness, a wish to keep power, not for himself, but because he'd truly come to believe he was the right person for God's job. And so I think he did divide and rule. Whereas I think almost alone among the generation of historians slightly above my own, you, John, have been willing to recognise there is a problem here, that people did sense that Cromwell was untrustworthy, that they saw him as a slippery customer. You saw that there was another Cromwell visible than the hero Cromwell of the 19th, early 20th century. But you're still prepared to have a greater liking for him, a greater faith in him
than I am. For years and years, I took a special subject called Oliver Cromwell and his critics, and we spent one term reading Cromwell and getting this very clear view of the man with a passionate religious conviction who was indeed pragmatic about how he realised it was uncompromising where he was headed. And then the second term, we looked at a range of about 18 people, all of whom thought he was a counting hypocrite.
Yeah.
And the historians have tended to kind of, on the whole, say, no, they were all wrong. But they were, you know, they were the entire political spectrum. Now, in the end, I am willing to support the view that we can take him at face value, by and large. But it's a very difficult and borderline case. And it comes basically from the fact that they are so incoherent in their account of whether he was always corrupt or whether he became corrupt. You know, there's no smoking gun. There are episodes when he appears to be extraordinarily self-serving. You can never actually catch him out. Now, he's not actually that intelligent or clever. I'm surprised if you can never catch him out. Anyway, we might come back to that in other sessions.
I think what worries me about Cromwell as a character is the way that he loses friends so easily.
Yes.
You've got somebody like Henry Vane in the late 1640s. They were very close. You had this group, closely knit group of people, Cromwell and some of the more Republican people. By 1653, they think that they're bitter enemies. They're supporting moves against him. They're protesting wildly against the dissolution of the realm. And also, you've got people like Lambert. I mean, Lambert, and you know, he's not the only one, but he's a prominent soldier, a great friend of Cromwell, who ends up falling out with him in 1657 and being thrown off the council, effectively.
Yeah.
But even those who are very close to him, people like Fleetwood and Desborough, Fleetwood being the son-in-law, Desborough being the brother-in-law, they're starting to have their doubts as well. Fleetwood over Ireland, because you've got lots of this sort of confiscation of Irish lands, and the army thinks, great, that's going to pay us. And then Cromwell says, oh, no, well, hang on, we'll make an exception for him, and you know, not her. And there's Fleetwood in Ireland going, you know, what is he doing? And the same with Desborough when it comes to the major generals, where the major generals are hamstrung because Cromwell keeps letting people off.
Yes.
And you've got this constant thing saying, we can't make this work financially because you know, Lord X and the Earl of Y have been let off from the decimation tax which you're supposed to pay for it.
Well, the key is how do you combine in one account of Cromwell his idealism and his realism? Because what you're talking about is him in bringing realism into situations where others were being you know so fanatical that they couldn't see how counterproductive an attempt to move everybody out of 28 of the 32 counties of Ireland you know was going to be. And how do you reach a sort of a realistic. So it's, for me, the real key is, and then you know how you balance those two is, and obviously I put more weight on the idealism while recognising the realism. Ronald thinks the realpolitik may have been more dominant.
Yes, it's just a slight shift of emphasis, but it's significant.
Well, the shift of emphasis is whether you think he's sincere about any of his religious,
Oh, no. No, we're totally at one on that. What I do see is a man who becomes convinced that God wants him there for a purpose. That so he's God's instrument.
We have other questions.
Paul. This issue of slipperiness and this tension between the realism and the idealism. There's quite a contrast between Cromwell the politician and Cromwell the soldier. Because Cromwell the soldier seems much of his success depends upon decision making that's there right from the beginning. He makes a decision, he sticks to it, he carries it through. And that doesn't appear to be the politician, particularly in the period we're talking about. But rather than slipperiness and the commitment to idealism on these two sides of him, there seems to be this element of complete indecision in what he's doing during the 56 to 57. He's committed to this moral reformation, but he sees the fruits of it in, say, the Navy case or something, and doesn't know what to do. And post the Western design, there's an element where providence has been lost to him. He's not sure whether he's got his own side. And you have this constitution. I wonder whether that might be a better explanation than just his realism. He seems a remarkably indecisive figure. And just looking at the Greek affair at the moment, you can see where indecision leads, where people are not quite sure what to do. Obviously, there's not the element of providence. He has lost it to some extent, and there's not that certainty.
Well, I'm not... yes and no. I mean, I think... obviously, I think on religion, he's very clear. He's very clear that the state has no right to dictate to people what to believe or how to worship, so long as they don't disrupt one another. And that persecution is always counterproductive. So there are that he believes not only in religious liberty, but religious equality. And that's really important, because there are a lot of people around who believe in religious liberty, but he really believes in religious equality. On politics, right back at Putney, he says, "I am a man not wedded and glued to forms of government. Forms of government are dross and dung in comparison of Christ." So he doesn't have any clear idea what form of government is going to deliver liberty. So he's always looking to other people to provide him with ideas. And he does, wait upon the Lord, but he also waits upon the Lord to give him advisors who will give him. One reason why he falls out with people is when their experiment doesn't work, he jettisons them very easily and brutally. And they then become very bitter about the way. Because for a while, he has got this much sort of misused word, but we have to use it, charisma. When you're with him, you think you're the only person that matters. So he has this extraordinary ability to charm people and to convince people that how important they are, until the moment at which he thinks, well, that idea was a daft idea. And then he just pushes them aside. And then they feel not the warmth of his affection, but the coldness of his rejection. But I think he's always committed to the ends of government. But he certainly has no idea at all, I think, about what the best means of government are. And you can see, we'll come on to that when we talk about kingship, because you might say that's another the indecisive period. And of course, a lot of historians have always said about Cromwell that there's long periods of hesitation and then decisiveness, that he's waiting for that point when he does believe that God has indicated to him what the next way forward is.
Last word from me, since I think I'm running out of time, and that is that the soldier and the politician, I think, are intimately connected. Cromwell is a slippery general. When he's in charge of an army, he never attacks from the front.
No.
And as a general, he is used to holding back until the moment to strike like a serpent. At Second Newbury on the Dunbar campaign, he doesn't launch a head-on attack again and again when he might. So I think the man is there from the beginning.
If you want to see what makes for an effective soldier and an ineffective politician, look at Fairfax.